Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, how Michelangelo envisaged the figure of Saint John the Baptist on the walls of the Sistine Chapel. A spiritual reflection focusing on love by well-known author and theologian Father Gerald O'Collins. But first, our reflection on this week's Sunday Gospel, a programme written and presented by Jill Bevilacqua by the intriguing title of There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, which begins as always with Sean Patrick Lovett reading the Gospel for us.
When Jesus heard of the death of John the Baptizer, he withdrew by boat to a deserted place by himself. The crowds heard of it and followed him on foot from the towns. When he disembarked and saw the vast throng, his heart was moved with pity, and he cured their sick. As evening drew on, his disciples came to him with the suggestion, "This is a deserted place, and it's already late. Dismiss the crowd so that they may go to the villages and buy some food for themselves." Jesus said to them, "There's no need for them to disperse. Give them something to eat yourselves." "We have nothing here," they replied, "but 5 loaves and a couple of fish." "Bring them here," he said. Then he ordered the crowds to sit down on the grass. He took the 5 loaves and 2 fish, looked up to heaven, blessed and broke them, and gave the loaves to the disciples, who in turn gave them to the people. All those present ate their fill. The fragments which remained when gathered up filled 12 baskets. Those who ate were about 5,000, not counting women and children.
Before we even begin to consider the event recounted in today's Gospel, known universally as the feeding of the 5,000, there's something which should give us pause, make us simply stand back and marvel. The crowds, the vast throng, as we've just heard, which followed Jesus on foot from the towns. The 4 evangelists all tell of this, and in fact the miracle which Jesus was to perform is the only one recounted by all 4. It was springtime. John tells us that it was shortly before the Jewish feast of Passover, probably sometime between February and March of the year 29 AD. The apostles had been sent by Jesus previously to proclaim the kingdom of God and to heal, writes Luke. And a scholar comments that this was their first experience of a mission, limited for the time to Galilee.
So they set out and went from village to village, proclaiming the good news and healing everywhere. On their return, the apostles gave him an account of all they had done.
Thus Luke, and Mark writes,
"The apostles rejoined Jesus and told him all they had done and taught. Then he said to them, 'You must come away to some lonely place all by yourselves and rest for a while.' For there were so many coming and going that the apostles had no time even to eat."
The reason for the departure of Jesus and the apostles to a lonely place seems to be chiefly so that they may have a chance to rest and eat without the crowds breathing down their necks. But there is another reason for the choice of the deserted place, and it's explained in the opening words of our Gospel. When Jesus heard, and in brackets follow the words, of the death of John the Baptizer. John the Baptist had been beheaded on Herod's orders after the request made by Salome, daughter of Herodias, for his head on a platter. But then Herod hears reports of another prophet preaching and healing. Writes Luke,
"Herod the Tetrarch had heard about all that was going on, and he was puzzled, because some people were saying that John had risen from the dead, others that Elijah had reappeared, still others that one of the ancient prophets had come back to life. But Herod said, 'John, I beheaded him, so who is this I hear such reports about?' And he was anxious to see him."
This, it seems, is the key phrase. Herod is a slippery fish, but he had not wanted to kill John. In his own way, he'd even admired him, even listened to him. But he was afraid of John's accusations and fearful of his seemingly mysterious power. For Herod has a guilty conscience, and now, from his superstitious fear of John, he passes to a superstitious fear of this new prophet. After they've buried him, John's disciples come to Jesus and tell him all this. Jesus does not fear for himself, but he now acts out of prudence. Writes Piero Bargellini.
A prudence which is not cowardice, but a wise and generous concern to avoid dangers to his disciples and followers from the political authorities, and trouble from the religious ones.
Hence the decision to leave Capernaum, which lay in Herod's territory, and cross over to that of his brother Philip. Where exactly did they go? John writes, to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. Luke, to a town called Bethsaida. But John also writes that Jesus climbed the hillside and sat down there with his disciples. And a scholar notes that they reached the top of a hill in the neighbourhood. Writes Bargellini.
If we look at a geographical map of the region, we see that Bethsaida was quite close to Capernaum and could easily be reached by water, just crossing a short arm of the lake. But what was particularly important, an administrative barrier ran between the two towns. Bethsaida was not in Galilee, but in Trachonitis, and that region was subject to Philip the Tetrarch, not Herod the Tetrarch.
So Jesus and his apostles get into the boat, writes Frank Sheed.
They crossed the northern corner of the lake by boat and came to a place with hills sloping to the water a few miles beyond Bethsaida. It was a desert place indeed, but they did not rest a while. The crowds, whose urgency had driven Jesus and the apostles to the last gasp of exhaustion, saw where the boat was going and followed round on foot. It would not have been more than 7 or 8 miles from Capernaum.
And the amazing thing is, as we read, that they ran there on foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them. Both Capernaum and Bethsaida have disappeared from the map. Archaeologists believe that the site of Capernaum is marked by a mound of black basalt ruins lying on the eastern bank of the lake. H.V. Morton wrote that within 10 minutes by boat from Capernaum is a little bay which is said to mark the site of Bethsaida. And our traveller comments.
When you know the shape of the Sea of Galilee, this incident becomes very vivid. While the little boat was crossing the 6 or 7 miles of water, a great multitude carrying their sick with them followed him on foot out of the cities. Evidently, the crowds had converged, as usual, on Capernaum. But when they discovered that the master had gone, they looked over the water to discover the direction of his boat. They saw with joy that he was going only to the opposite shore, probably to the little fishing port of Bethsaida Julius at the inlet of the Jordan. This meant that if they lost no time and, racing round the northern end of the lake, waded over the shallow Jordan, they would reach Bethsaida Julius almost as soon as Jesus.
And in fact, as we know, they got there before him, and he would have soon realised this. Incidentally, while Morton gives Bethsaida a second name of Julius, an Italian scholar writes.
Bethsaida is often mentioned in the Gospels. According to John, it was the hometown of Philip, Andrew and Peter. It was a village of fishermen on the north bank of the Sea of Galilee, a little to the east of the point where the River Jordan enters the lake. Philip the Tetrarch transformed the village into a town. It was called Julia, perhaps in honour of the daughter of the Roman Emperor Augustus.
And continuing his account, H.V. Morton writes.
As Jesus crossed the water, he would see this great race of over 5,000 round the north end of the lake, and he would know that whatever thoughts he may have had of praying in a desert place apart and of meditation on the death of the forerunner were fated to be given up in service to the crowds. No sooner had he landed than the crowds came to him.
and presumably they followed him relentlessly up the green hill. What the exhausted apostles thought at this point we're not told. Bargellini writes that neither Jesus nor the disciples showed any trace of disappointment. Indeed, Luke says he welcomed them. Matthew, as in our Gospel today, writes, "When he disembarked and saw the vast throng, his heart was moved with pity, and he cured their sick." While Mark tells us that he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. Writes Sheed.
Once more the sight of the crowd was too much for Jesus' resolution. Once more the teaching and the healing began and went on steadily through the day. By the end of the afternoon, they were still thronged about with people, 5,000 of them, to say nothing of women and children, adds Matthew, who as a tax collector had been accustomed to counting heads.
But it's growing late, and the disciples prudently suggest to Jesus that he send the crowds away to go and buy themselves food in one or other of the neighbouring villages. "There's no need for them to go. Give them something to eat yourselves," is the surprising answer. And here the evangelists give their separate versions of what happened next. Matthew recounts simply, "All we have with us is 5 loaves and 2 fish. Bring them here to me," he said. Mark has the disciples answering, "Are we to go and spend 200 denarii on bread for them to eat?" "How many loaves have you?" he asked. "Go and see." And when they had found out, they said, 5 and 2 fish. Luke's account is somewhat similar. "We have no more than 5 loaves and 2 fish, unless we're to go ourselves and buy food for all these people." John's account contains details none of the others mention. Jesus speaks to Philip.
"Where can we buy some bread for these people to eat?" He only said this to test Philip. He himself knew exactly what he was going to do. Philip answered, 200 denarii would only buy enough to give them a small piece each. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said, "There's a small boy here with 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. But what is that between so many?"
Apart from the reference to Philip and Andrew, John is also the only evangelist to describe the loaves as barley loaves, which some commentators have seen as a reference to the miracle in the Old Testament of Elisha during a famine.
"A man came from Baal Shalisha, bringing the man of God bread from the first fruits, 20 barley loaves and fresh grain in the ear. 'Give it to the people to eat,' Elisha said. But his servant replied, 'How can I serve this to 100 men? "Give it to the people to eat," he insisted, "for Yahweh says this, 'They will eat and have some left over.' He served them, they ate, and had some left over, as Yahweh had said."
And finally, a scholar reminds us that barley bread was the usual food of the poor. H.V. Morton writes that commentators have imagined that the boy with the loaves and fishes was one of the bread boys still to be seen in Arab towns, sometimes with strips of dried fish, which they sell with the bread. And he goes on.
"There's one point in St. John's Gospel of the miracle which is extremely interesting. In describing the fish eaten on this occasion, he uses the Greek word opsarion, which our translators render as small fish. St. John is the only evangelist to use this word, and the real meaning is not small fish, but a savoury dish, or as we might say, hors d'oeuvres. This is exactly what the small pickled fish of Galilee were in the time of Christ."
This is a wonderful instance of the vivid local colour which has been detected in the fourth gospel, because no one unacquainted with the life and speech of Galilee could have employed this word. And as we know, the fish was used as a symbol of Christ by the early Christians, on account of the fish mentioned in this miracle. Moreover, the letters of the Greek word for fish, ichthus, formed an acronym of the initial letters of the words Jesus Christ, Son of God, Saviour. Mark too, writes Sheed, giving us Peter's memory of the great day makes the scene most vivid. And we come to the moment when our Lord tells the apostles, in Mark's words, to get all the people together in groups on the green grass. And John writes, there was plenty of grass there. But she goes on.
It is Peter who remembers that the grass was of the light green colour of spring, and that the groups sitting in their many-coloured robes looked like beds of flowers. But you have to go to the Greek to find that.
Who would have thought that Peter was such a poet? Or was it Mark? And talking of the grass, a scholar confirms that it was springtime.
The mention of the green grass gives us to understand that the incident took place in the spring, when the rainy season was hardly over. In the summer, it hardly ever rains and everything is burnt up by the sun.
Another detail which scholars point out to us is the reference, not mentioned by Matthew or John, to the numbers of the groups. In Luke we read that Jesus said, "Get them to sit down in parties of about 50," while Mark writes, "Then he commanded them all to sit down by companies upon the green grass. So they sat down in groups by hundreds and by fifties." The reference to 5,000 men, mentioned by all four evangelists, seems, writes the scholar, to allude to the traditions of the Exodus, where the people are presented as a group of almost military discipline and order. But as for the specific numbers of the groups, he writes,
"The texts which reproduce the rule of the Qumran community testify that in the time of Jesus it was thought that at the end of time the community would be reconstructed by God according to that model of Israel in the desert."
And so this marvellous, miraculous picnic began. He gave thanks. Eucharisted is John's word, we read. Blessed and broke the loaves, shared out the fish. All those present ate their fill. The fragments which remained when gathered up filled 12 baskets. A scholar again.
The manner of telling the story of the miracle emphasizes its significance. Jesus, with his word and with the gift of his bread, is the food of his people on their journey through the desert.
And Sheed reminds us.
When St. John tells us that the first teaching on the Blessed Eucharist was so soon to follow, we see a reason why Jesus should have wanted to work this particular miracle at this precise moment.
And we're told that some of the terms John uses in his account are present in the oldest liturgical texts of the Church, such as the Didache. The Greek word synagein, to gather, gave origin to the term synaxis, which indicates the gathering together of the Christian community for the Eucharist. The Greek klasmata, pieces left over, indicated the broken bread, symbol of the scattered church, which must be gathered together in unity. And let's end with this extract from Piero Bargellini's story of the Gospels. Whereas John uses the phrase, "he gave thanks," the other three evangelists write, "he said the blessing." And Bargellini explains.
This was a Hebrew prayer, usually recited by the father of the family. It was a beautiful prayer, which went like this. "Blessed be you, O Lord our God, who have sanctified us with your commandments, and who draw bread out of the earth." And as if it had really been drawn out of the earth, inexplicably but undeniably, the bread of the boy's 5 loaves multiplied miraculously in the hands of Jesus, until all the 5,000 men, women, and children had all eaten their fill on the green grass of the meadow.
And many thanks once again to Jill Bevilacqua for this beautiful programme. She'll be back again at this same time next week. Meanwhile, moving on in the broadcast, time to go arty with our Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Ennis, who helps us better understand the figure of St. John the Baptist on the walls of the Sistine Chapel, in particular in the Last Judgment fresco.
This wonderful moment.
Breda, studio, we're still speaking about the last judgment. We didn't think we'd ever end somehow.
And if we did all 400 figures, we would be here for the next 2 years.
We're going to speak about a very important figure again today. Looking at the fresco, he's to the left of Christ.
Yes, yes.
And he's John the Baptist.
Yes. Looking as intense as he is described, in a sense, because a very intense figure and
a devilish face, in a way.
No, it's almost like it's severe more than devilish. No, he's very severe, but he's generally portrayed dressed in unkempt clothes and looking like a wild man from the desert. And looking very severe, which in fact he was. Yeah, because actually what he's trying to do is, no, more than that, he's trying to warn people, like, Messiah is coming. He's very near. So wake up, you people. This is the feeling you get from this figure. And it's lovely when you look at the eyes. I mean, he has a hooked nose. He's not exactly a fabulous-looking individual. He's not a beautiful-looking man, if you want to put it that way. But there was a wonderful expression in his eyes, though. Look, he's looking with an adoration at the figure of Christ the Judge in the middle. Because this was the content of his message. This was his role. And he's a very special man. He's celebrated on the 24th of June, which is his birthday, on the 29th of August as well, which was the day of his martyrdom. So he's the only saint, along with the Virgin Mary and Jesus, whose birthday is celebrated as a feast, an official church feast. All the others are celebrated on the day of their martyrdom or their death. And this is because he was sanctified already before his birth, because his actual birth was miraculous in a sense, and he prepared humanity for the coming of Christ.
So he's an in-between man. He's between the Old Testament and the New Testament.
Yes, he's the last prophet from the Old Testament and the first one of the New. So he is a link.
The glue.
Well, yeah, more than that, it's almost like he clasps the two. He brings the two books together. More than even binding them, it's almost like he's putting some wonderful gold clip on the two of them to hold them together strongly. This is the feeling I always get.
That's a beautiful image.
He's a very, very important key figure in the linking of the two books. I mean, when I think of him in terms of the key figure, I'm jumping over also to St. Peter with his keys at the same thing. Because you always find some types of images that tend to float around certain figures. And he's one of these people.
Well, the way they're placed.
They're the two, let's say, they're standing straight up and the two strongest, more muscular figures in the Last Judgment fresco. Because the Christ figure, yes, it is a muscular one, but it's more refined. The figures of John the Baptist and Peter are stronger and more rugged, let's say. A little bit like Hercules, the statue of Hercules. So when people asked him who he was, St. John, he answered, "The voice of one crying in the wilderness." And you can actually feel the intensity of this in this face that you see here. And look, his arms are down by his sides. So it's almost like he understands that what he had to do was done. And of course, remember that Christ chose him to be baptized. So he was baptizing before the arrival of Christ. And then the real baptism, he had this wonderful gift that Christ chose him to be baptized in the River Jordan.
Rhea, apart from this depiction of both St. Peter and St. John the Baptist in the Last Judgment fresco, these two figures appear elsewhere in the Sistine Chapel in a different manner.
You have the fresco on the lower part of the Sistine, where you have Peter receiving the keys from Christ. You also have the first fresco just to the right of the altar, where you see St. John the Baptist baptizing Christ. And again, in that fresco below, he's shown in his more classical garb, holding the long cross, standing with one foot on a rock and one foot in the water, and he's baptizing Christ. And he's wearing the robes that we normally associate him with. So again, it's a repetition here. He's repeated in the Sistine Chapel. So this also underlines the importance of his role. He sometimes holds a lamb, which has a cruciform nimbus, no? The lamb is one of his iconographical attributes, because he was the one who said, "Behold the Lamb of God." He's here to one side of Christ, and he's the person who brought the message to the people and brought the direct link to the Messiah who came. And on the other side, you have St. Peter, who received that message and brought it down into the Sistine Chapel for us. And this is why this link with the Pope is so terribly important, because you're coming through the prophets, through the revelation, which is an action. Obviously, here you have the judgment, but it's the judgment as the result of the revelation. And then on the right-hand side, you have Peter, who created, let's say, the earthly church. And then below that, you have the altar of the Pope.
Michelangelo was a very knowledgeable person about the church.
Well, not only knowledgeable, but he was also very religious. This is something people tend to forget, because I think Michelangelo had this extraordinary capacity to immerse himself in what he was trying to paint. And trying to give the totality of his spiritual self to creating something that would give and inspire a message in the people who are observing for years to come.
And heartfelt thanks there, as always, to our Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Ennis, who's currently teaching at the American University of Rome, and who, as you may have gathered, happens to be an artist herself. And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget, we'll be back again at this same time tomorrow. Meanwhile, should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Laudetur Jesus Christus.